Welcome to Wednesdays with Willa. I am your host, Willa White, and this is my weekly podcast show that airs on Wednesday mornings at 10 a.m. Eastern on my Facebook page, Willa White Media. It also goes out on my YouTube channel, as well as the Lilydale Radio Blog Talk Radio channel. So I encourage you to look back at the archive videos of past shows. I've had a lot of great guests, a lot of great topics. We usually are talking about spiritualism, mediumship, healing, faith, family, or more. And today I am blessed to have on the show Dr. Christopher Kerr. Thanks for being here today, Dr. Kerr.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It's going to be wonderful to be able to chat with you today about those end of life visions, that people are experiencing in the dying process. And for those of you who don't know who Dr. Christopher Kerr is, he is the Chief Medical Officer and CEO of Hospice in Buffalo, New York, which is not too far from Lilydale. You're about an hour drive for those who want some reference where they can find Buffalo, New York. But under your leadership, your medical leadership, you serve in Hospice Buffalo about 1,200 patients a day, and you're able to really work with them on one-on-one basis, but also you've been able to document so many of their end-of-life visions and the dreams that they're having, the experiences of spirit loved ones that are coming to them and comforting them. And I know you're going to tell us a little bit about that today. And you've also did a wonderful TED Talk that is many people are can go and access the TED Talk online if they like to watch that. And it's beautiful. I can't remember how long. It's like 18 minutes, so it's not super long. So as far as the time commitment goes, but you've been also in documentaries in on PBS. And people are really excited about the studies and the work that you're doing. And of course, that compassionate side to what you're helping other people to recognize in taking care of their loved ones that are going through end of life, or what they may be experiencing themselves as they approach the end of so-called life here on this earth plane. So it's really exciting to have you here with us today to tell us a bit more about that dying process, what you're able to see, and what you're able to help other people to express and to experience in a loving way.
Thank you very much. Nice introduction.
Oh, thanks. So, in terms of getting us going into the dying process and what you're able to do, how did it come about that you decided, let's start to really focus in on this. Let's shed some light on this in a public way so people can understand about that end of life process and the visions that their loved ones are experiencing. I myself, before I got married and had children, I was a hospice volunteer for a few years,
Oh.
and I really enjoyed going into people's homes or the nursing home or the hospital, wherever I was assigned. And it was just a beautiful experience. It's difficult because I get close to them in that sense of, oh, I want to shed the tears. But there were times where I was there to comfort them, or sometimes I was there to comfort their caregivers even more so in the conversations that we would have. And they had their own journeys that they made, and that journey is such an individual experience that we express. So if you could tell us a bit more about some of the experiences you've been honored to witness, that'd be
Sure.
great.
So I'll answer the first question, I guess, which is how did we even get here to do this
Yeah.
work? And it's a story unto itself because none of this was intentional. It was very, very much by accident. It was in 99, and I was actually a fellow in cardiology, and I was just trying to support my family, do work on the side, and came to hospice just to on weekends. And it's an odd role for a doctor who's trained in contemporary times because we're so focused on doing things to people, and when they're no longer treatable, we tend to drift off, and there's a form of abandonment, and so I didn't know what I was doing basically, and when I just had to be present at the bedside, and there was no more doing, and. It was really my colleagues in nursing and social work and chaplaincy who showed me, well, there's the objective side of dying, the one we see. And then there's the one that the patient experiences. So the subjective or the experiential piece, the view from the bed. And it was recognizing that they were having these unshared experiences. And at first, I was dubious and I did what doctors do, which was try to medicalize it as a state of delirium or confusion. And what happened was there was this number of cases where it was so demonstrably therapeutic that it didn't really matter whether I understood the etiology, or it was the benefit to the patient and their loved ones was just so profound. So I learned to gradually have more and more reverence for what the patient was just experiencing. And what happened was I was trying to teach it to young doctors, and they would say what young doctors say, well, there's no evidence for this. And in fact, it's been in the literature in the humanities and religion in every culture since the beginning of time. And but it wasn't in modern day doctor speak. So that's what led to the studies. And it's kind of funny because we didn't publish the studies for 10 years because we never thought anyone would have an interest in it. And what's fascinating is that we were right and that medicine didn't have a whole lot of interest in it, but the rest of the world, the people who were receiving care, witness to care, caregiving, and it just kept going around the world. But it was never intended that way. It was intended for a medical audience. And in fact, what's kind of funny was I knew the scene was believing, so we started filming patients early. So we did the studies, and we did them in a very disciplined way. So we ruled out confusion. Everybody was screened for delirium or confusional states. We looked at labs, we looked at meds, all the things that you do. And we would do that every time we interviewed somebody, but we also started filming. And we were just doing it with a handheld camera, never knowing that it would end up in documentaries. But that's how it happened. It was completely by accident. And what's propelled it is that there was clearly a hunger for this to be validated and for this to be placed in a clinical context where it mattered. And I can't state it enough. We didn't discover anything. We just shone a light on something that was always known, but perhaps lost. And you know, the time is right because people don't want the doctor's death. They don't want a medicalized death. They want a closing of a life, not an organ failure experience. And people don't die in parts. And they die in the context of their loved ones. So they want something different. So there was an appetite for it. So that's how it began. That's how we got here.
It's really beautiful that you've been able to have such a supportive team to see that through, and that the patients they wanted to be part of that, right? So you when you would rule out, okay, they have dementia at this point, they have Alzheimer's, they wouldn't be a good candidate or the other for the other reasons that you mentioned, but the patients wanted to be involved in that study.
Yeah, it's fun. I'm glad you mentioned that because that's actually the story within the story. So the university that approved studies was initially denied them because we tend to treat the dying patient as though they need to be sterilized, put on a shelf, kept quiet. And dying's lonely. It's isolating. And people want to connect. They want to have meaning. They want their words to matter. They want to be heard. And what we found was remarkable is everybody wanted to participate. And they wanted to be seen, they wanted to be filmed, whether they were broken and disheveled, scarred, bleeding, they just didn't care. And there's beauty in that because there was no secondary gain for them. They weren't going to be alive, they weren't benefiting in any way. But it, you know, hope kind of changes for a dying patient from hope of curing to hope for others.
Right.
And giving mattered enormously. And we're looking at that because that was not what was predicted. But yeah, everybody participates. It's fascinating. And of course, the opposite was thought by the university. No one's going to say yes, and you need to leave them alone. Meanwhile, you know, they're looking up at a white ceiling. So yeah, dying's lonely.
It absolutely can be very lonely. It
And
can be
isolating.
for the caregiver, it can be lonely for the person who's experiencing it.
Yeah.
because, people don't always know what to say. They don't always know what to do to help them. And I found that the most useful thing I could do was, instead of trying to focus on speaking to their conscious self, I could talk to their soul. And
Yeah.
then things were much more effective in terms of being able to assist them. And the people who were sharing their experiences, these end of life visions and dreams, can you share a few of those instances with us so people have an idea? Maybe they're not very familiar, they're not.
Yeah, I'll give a rough sketch to the kind of the first
Yes,
study. We've
please.
been, had eight studies and or manuscripts. The first one, what we did was dying's a process. So we interviewed people daily as they got close to death, sometimes weeks and months beforehand, and wanting to understand what their experience was. And it was just a standardized survey. Are you having dreams and visions, comforted, discomforting, neither? We asked them, we had a menu of what content they could see. They measured comfort from these. Then we had a more qualitative study where we would interview them and ask for interpretation. And a long story short is what we found is there was an increasing frequency of these dreams or visions as people approached death. And as you got nearer to death, it was ever more populated by people who you had seen and who had passed. They were 88% were extremely comforting. And the discomforting ones were some of the most transformational ones. You kind of you die as you live, and if you had PTSD, you may have had a discomforting dream, but it was important because somebody came back and tell you and relieve you of your responsibility, kind of thing. So they were very healing in that sense. The nomenclature of what we call these things is highly problematic, because we use the term dreams, but patients are emphatic. They say things like, I don't normally dream, or I don't recall my dream. And they say, you don't understand this. They describe it as a lived or virtual event. Absolutely not confusion. They were intact. They were organized. They were drawn from real life. They were remembered. They had meaning. There tended to be this editing process where you focused on those that loved you unconditionally or secured you. So it might be one parent, not another, one sibling, not the others. So they're very specific people. What was fascinating was very little was said between people. They just seemed to know. So they didn't need, which is really interesting. And this is very important for your audience, very distinct from your death experiences. So they weren't given a message. There was nothing to analyze. There's no metaphor. There's no epiphany. The time for therapy is over. You're actually dying. The overarching theme is one of being put back together, made whole. So if you're 95 and you lost your mother when you were five, it's her voice you hear. It's her perfume and smell. You don't need a translation. So I've never had a patient wake up and say, hey, doctor, what do you think this means? If you see your deceased mother, you don't need an explanation. It's personal, it's to your core, you own it. There's no tunnels, there's no white light, there's no, this is the meaning of life stuff. This is what your job is, go tell others. You write a book, whatever. It's just nothing like that.
It's
They
very
just,
different from a near-death experience.
oh, totally. And
Very
it should,
different.
right? I mean, this is, yeah, very, 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 very different. And it's when we measured realism on a 1 to 10 scale, 10 being the most realistic, the most common number was 10.
And if they could give a 10 plus, they probably would have.
Yeah, and then they make it unarguable, and there really isn't a need to necessarily share that. They're just given the sense of knowing. And then there's like a large subset where, we're all wounded for having lived, and these emotional wounds tend to be addressed. I can give you some examples, mothers who lose babies and they're holding their babies. A mother whose child was in prison is validated as a mother. An old man who lost his arm as a boy was worried and traumatized with identity. How am I going to work? How am I going to be? How am I going to be independent? And at the end of his life, all his coworkers come and tell him he was the best at his job. So it's very specific to the individual. So discomforting themes don't mean aren't without meaning. So it's specific to the life that was led. But the overall, so what it seems to happen is that, and these experiences don't deny death, right? None of them are death denying. They seem to transcend it across lives. So it doesn't seem to matter. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. There's this interconnection, in a way that just seems to make sense. They're not, they often want to go back to them.
Yeah.
The theme of travel is present in about 35 to 40%, metaphorically, like doing something, someone waiting for them. We did a study where we looked at the what were the qualitative categories, and that was very common. Pets are huge, which is again consistent with this idea of unconditional love. So they're very often, time and distance are gone. So it didn't matter how old you are and how far apart you are in time from this loved one, they're there. Children do this in very interesting ways. We published on that. People who are cognitively different do it in very rich ways, with dementia, Down syndrome, etc. So nobody's kind of denied in a way. So that kind of sums up the first series of papers.
Beautiful. I think that's it's such a wealth of information that you've been able to accumulate and then be able to share. And as you said, when it comes to mediumship, I've been a medium all these years. That's how it is. You just know there. It's called clear cognizance, which is just a knowing that happens. And also, would you also say they had clairsentient feeling, like feelings, not just of the love, but that what made it real in their experience that they had with their loved ones, whoever they needed their healing connection with. That they could feel things happening, that there was a sensory experience that they
oh, very much
existing in. And so that's what it's like when you have a mediumship experience too.
Very, very much. Yeah.
And it's not just a hologram effect or like you just see a little bit of their face. It's full vision that they're experiencing at those times.
And it doesn't, it's not a puzzle that needs to be put together. It's just there.
There's a clarity. And, I often say that nothing trumps personal experience. People can talk about these things, but until they're in them, they really don't understand the true far-reaching connection that's being made. And that our loved ones in spirit they visit around us. They gather in around people when they are in need, when they're in a crisis, when they're about ready to pass. They're there to help be the support during that time. And this is kind of giving evidence to those things for people, maybe making them more open to the understanding that they are a soul and that they will exist beyond that because they're able to connect with the souls of their loved ones, be they human or pets, like you said. That's really such a beautiful facet and of this.
We're doing a study now. So we were very clear not to assign interpretation to this, religious, paranormal, other, because we just wanted to be able to translate literally what we were being told by our patients. But we're doing a study now that looks at how they interpret this existentially, that sort of thing. Religious themes were very uncommon. The iconography of religion, but the tenets of faith, of love and forgiveness were everywhere. We did another series of studies where we looked at dying as a post-traumatic growth. So this idea within a perceived negative experience, could you gather, was there positive psychology and benefit? What we found was people who were having these experiences showed that they were actually adapting and gaining insight and learning right to the very end. So that in the end, dying is this paradox, right? You're physically declining, but spiritually, emotionally, you're vibrant, you're alive, you're very acutely aware, you're learning, you're gaining insights. So the take home is that you don't stop living because you're dying, is clearly the case.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was a really interesting study.
Yeah. Sometimes the healing, you know, when you're praying for someone to be healed, you're praying for someone to recover from a horrible illness or maybe from, you know, come back from the brink of death, as it were. And sometimes the most healing thing for them is to go ahead and pass. And yep. for them to get to that place of peace and acceptance and a willingness, shall we say, to yep. give over to the next yep. and to appreciate and value what they've experienced, the lessons, the joys that have all come through a life. And would you say also their family and friends, if they have them around them, when does this get shared with them as well? So that they
yeah, we've published two very large scale studies looking at the bereaved. And you know, people don't die isolated, they die in the context of the people they love. And so the central tenet of hospice is the unit of care is not just the patient but those around them. And we've done two studies. And basically what we've shown was that what's good for the patient is good for the loved one, and how we see people leave us matters.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see someone dying as empty finality, or you can see them rich in love and meaning. And, you know, the easiest example we have is, you know, a couple that shared a child and the child was lost. And you know, you're looking at your life partner of 6 and 7 decades and they're experience their presence or their love. Well, that absolutely changes how the remaining person goes on. We actually did a study where we looked at grief as a measures of grief processing, mm-hmm. and it was done in a much more, there were more positive dimensions to it if they had witnessed someone who had these experiences. So yes. Yeah, it's, we don't, so, you know, dying itself isn't about parts ending, and dying is not just about the entity of the person. It extends to all they love. Mm-hmm. And so this is, this matters.
Yeah, it does matter. And it's such an important message that you're able to then help people know this is what the normal is. This is what life is. What's part of life is part of death. And so often in a reading, for instance, that'll get mentioned. I saw so-and-so, remember when I saw so-and-so before I passed, or they'll mention, I know my passing, while difficult, because you were able to really support me through that experience. You see that as a joyful thing that I've passed. And I'm so glad. I'm so glad that my passing has been able to uplift you in some way. That sometimes is a message that they come through from spirit to offer. And it's just consistent what's being shown in your studies and what's being experienced in the after life of people. And have you in any of these studies had someone have more than one dream, or if there's just one pivotal dream or vision that comes, or would you say that some people are prone to multiple experiences?
Oh, very much. Yeah. They can't wait to go to bed to find out what's going to happen next. So yeah, they, very much.
And so they're reveling in this.
We've got videos, and they struggle to find the words to express what they're experiencing, and they want to go back to it. Again, there's not a lot of language content in these experiences. It's just understood and felt.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't require words, really. There's very few words. They're often multiple. And people will say, you know, I've seen my brother, my mother, but I know it's not time because I haven't seen my husband.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Mm-hmm. So, in terms of this showing that people do survive death, do you feel that having those end-of-life visions of their loved ones really not just help them in being able to accept their passing, but they're able to step into that with a measure of joy?
Yeah, I don't think that they become less death focused. I can't explain it. I can't. We haven't studied. That's what we're studying now. Is how do you make sense of this? Observationally, I can tell you that it doesn't seem the fear of death is definitely lessened, and they it just seems to make sense to them, whatever it is that's happening. If that makes any sense.
Yes. And
Yeah.
as things are unraveling in inside of them, there's this kind of they're becoming unwound in some ways. The things that they had held tension about, maybe even things that they've forgotten about, that start to surface within them. It's almost like things are stirred up in a slightly different way of experience.
Yeah.
And has anyone experienced those visions with them? Is another question I would have for you. Is anyone in the same room and is able to sense
Maybe,
this?
yeah, and I'm probably a bad person to ask this because I'm going to give you two answers. My own answer is I don't see it a lot at that. And that may be a reflection of my own limitations or biases. I'm not sure. There are certainly people who look at this. There's a guy in California and his, it's called the Shared Crossing Project. And, he documents this. The only caveat there, he does it kind of retrospectively and talking to the bereaved, which is very different than doing it in real time with the patient included. So it's not something that I can say that I've witnessed a lot, but I certainly know people talking about it. But again, the caveat there may just be me. So.
Well, it's just an aspect of it. So when more than one person is able to experience it in a unified way, because a person doesn't have to be dying in order to connect with spirit and to have that awareness that someone is in the room. If their mom is dying and they're there visiting and the mom sees the dad next to her bedside, and there can be an awareness that happens within the caregiver or loved one.
I think for the most part, it's not that complicated. I think what happens is they're usually referencing somebody the other person knows. So it's a shared love, it's a shared life experience. The relationship, they're interconnected, the dynamics are pretty cohesive between the people. So they don't have to do it in the spiritual sense, except that it's very reality based. So two sisters who, and one of them seeing their mom, two parents and they're seeing their child. A child is seeing watching their mom reference their dog, their family dog. It seems to be this weave between the lives that is based on shared life. So they're drawn to one another, whether, and I don't, I so I see that that's a given. And that's what I meant when it seems to connect lives, whether they're living or whether they're dead. So like it's wonderful. It's like looking through an old photo album, but you're not looking at it by yourself. You're looking at it with your family and your loved ones, and everybody's drawn to the memory, the experience. And in the end, I think what happens is that dying becomes life affirming, not life denying. You're affirming having lived mattered, being present. And the what fascinates me is that the strongest forms of these loves are never really gone. They're accessible to these people. They're tangent to these people. They can. They're proximate. They can grab them, and that's a beautiful version of a story, right? That at the end of your life, the things that matter most, your greatest achievements, are your relationships, and they come to surface. They're there for you. So it kind of, I think what it's done for me is that it throws out this notion of time, because I'm continually impressed when you watch old men relive moments of their life from 8 decades ago, like they're happening, like they're real. Were they gone? They're always in them, So it's really wonderful.
Yeah, it is a timeless space, and one of the benefits of you doing this work and other people who are there and present with folks that are passing or in the aftermath of helping people through grief, we have that beautiful benefit of understanding that we can bring joy to our process of living.
Yes.
Would you say you are very close to death on a daily basis, other people's passings, not just your own, but this idea you see this happen time and time again. And some people would say, well, that's a gloomy thing, or they would say that what a how do you handle that? That's such a negative experience. And what do you have to say to people who would maybe have
Oh,
that belief?
I would say it's a limited view, and it's that's not based in our experience. So, I often say that people would assume people who work at hospice are depressed or at least depressing. And in fact, if you go there, it's life-filled and there's humor. And I think what it is it's a difference between when we imagine dying from a state of health, we're fear-ridden and all of those things. We're meant to fight against the dimming of the light. When you get to the actual dying process and disease is burdensome and tiresome, and you get to a different level of peace and acceptance, so the patients aren't in that state of mind. But what it is really is that we're witnessed the very best of humanity. Because what you see is remarkable caregiving, courage, selflessness, strength, and love people didn't know they had in them. Their lives stop to remember, to cherish one another. So yeah, there's sadness, but in the end, again, it's not denying life or death, but it's more celebrating one another. I mean, caregivers themselves are inspirational, and they do heroic things, and they tell us that that we're capable of remarkable things. And patients themselves, patients who long since passed, knowing that they had a future on this earth, are still caring for others. There's gestures as they're trying to say goodbye that are powerful. So no, I get where people would think that, but I mean, there's death obviously that's sadder than others, unfinished lives, mothers who have children still, all those sorts of things. It's undeniable. I'm not trying to sugarcoat that, but it's an in you're missing a few chapters in the book if you think that's where it ends,
That's
because
right.
there is much more powerful, threads of humanity in the dying process for everybody that's involved. And so yeah, no.
Yeah, I think people find a selfless part of themselves, even if they're tired, even if they don't necessarily want the burden day in, day out of caregiving. There's something inside of them that rises to the occasion and sees that through. And I've met so many people over the years that have told me that they were grateful they were able to spend that time with their loved one.
Oh yeah, I mean the overriding theme is it was the best, hardest thing I'd ever done.
There you go. There you
And
go. So where do you see this going? You've done so many studies already. How many studies have you done total and thus far, and how many have
probably
taken?
eight. Yeah, I wanted to end a long time ago and do other studies. I like doing things like drug studies, just like for. But what happens is it's what propels it forward is the response. Like you keep thinking it's going away, and then there's not a day go by we don't hear from somebody. There's very we're involved in a very interesting documentary with a three-time award-winning filmmaker from Australia. And what she's doing is she's coupling our Western-based research with the belief systems of the indigenous people of the Amazon and Australia, outback, and showing that the universality of this experience, which is is common to the human experience. And so that's being done. I'm very interested in that. I'm interested in the study that we're looking at. Okay, so this happens, yes, and there's post-traumatic growth, yes, and it matters to the bereaved, yes, and children do it, and people with cognitively different do it. But what do they take from this? What is the final translation for them? What does it change about their beliefs, about their religion, afterlife, the soul, all those sort of things? I don't want to speculate on those things for them. I never will. I want to know what they think. So that's where we're kind of looking at.
So you've done the eight studies, you've got some more happening and documentaries that are then spinning off from these things. And
Yeah.
so there's no end in sight for you.
No, we're doing, we're doing some very interesting stuff with caregivers, looking at this role of gratitude. And it's amazing what we're seeing.
Oh, we can't wait to see what more things you'll come up with and more things
Thank
you'll
you.
share. And we're just so grateful that you and your research team are so dedicated and that you're able to do such beautiful work at Hospice
Thank you.
Buffalo. And I know people are really excited that you're coming to Lilydale this summer. For
Ah.
those of you who haven't marked your calendars, it's July 14th, 15th, and 16th. There's a whole near-death experience weekend that Dr. Kerr is part of, and you're going to be talking about the dying process. You're going to be talking more about these end-of-life visions, and people can get tickets from the lilydaleassembly.org website. And I'll also post a link here to make it easy so that you can attend everything that Dr. Kerr is going to come and do here at Lilydale, so you can see him in person and be part of this beautiful story that we're all creating together. And I
Great.
really appreciate you coming on the show today.
Well, thank you. Wonderful questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. And we can't thank you enough for the work that you're doing and this continuing study. The work you're doing is propelling a lot of understanding forward. Hopefully the scientific community will get more on board as the evidence is mounting.
Yes. Yes.
What we know to be truth within ourselves. And thank you everyone for tuning in today. I'll look forward to being here for another Wednesdays as well next week, where I'll have Dr. Raymond Moody on the show, and we'll talk more about life after death. All right, you be well, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.